Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We spent a good chunk of our program reflecting on the past 3 years from one of the leading medical experts in our area, Dr. Dean Blumberg from UC Davis Health. Now we want to turn to what the future looks like here in California. As the emergency declaration expires, life goes on, maybe a little differently, maybe a little less cautiously for some, maybe more for others. Since we're located at Sac State, we asked people on campus how they're reflecting on the past 3 years.
Well, there's still many cases, new cases reported every day, and people are still dying of it. It's not the crisis that it was early on, but it's still here and with us. It's probably going to wind up being a situation where you have to get a vaccine every year, just like you have to get a flu shot every year.
Everything's changed over the last 3 years, I'd say, for me. I was one of the people who quit my job in 2021, along with the other tens of millions of other Americans. And I think it's we all went through this sort of period of time that seemed like missing years of our lives. And now it's nice to be back to normal.
Definitely changed how I view a lot of things, just like how people like attacked one another for personal choices that they made on themselves. So I kind of like moved different because like I watched my sister lose a lot of friends because me and my family personally didn't get the vaccine. So we lost a lot of like friends over it, and then even family members didn't want to see us for the longest time.
I do not think it's over. I think the pandemic is still alive. I think that politicians got enough, they didn't like all the flack they were getting, and they downed it a little bit. And I think I'm not alone in saying that we could be going back to that anytime. And I think by seeing my fellow students here wearing masks, they feel the same.
So while the pandemic is still with us, California clearly is moving forward. To help us answer some of the questions of what all this means, we're joined by Janelle Salonga, Cap Radio's Sacramento Communities reporter, and Kate Wolf, Cap Radio's healthcare reporter. Thanks for joining us on what is really a milestone day.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Vicky.
Thanks, Vicky.
So before we dig in, I want to hear from the both of you just as people outside of the journalist world. Janelle, I want to start with you. What have the past 3 years been like for you? You were just graduating from college.
Yeah, I mean, it felt very surreal to graduate. I graduated in March 2021. This was just at the time when people were just starting to get vaccinated. So I actually did walk in a graduation ceremony in June. But, I started at Cap Radio in April of that year, and I didn't really feel, a hard break between the end of college and the start of Cap Radio, because we at the office are still actually working pretty hybrid. I think now there's people coming into the studio a lot more often. But yeah, at the time I started, it was definitely really surreal to be like, oh, I'm working here now, when my brain still felt like, I was doing online school and I'm doing online interviews. So yeah, definitely a change that didn't really feel like one. And I think, as the pandemic has kind of gone on, it's been, I think I've seen it be compared of the feeling of kind of like a group project that we were all in it together at the beginning. And now the work is kind of being dropped onto other people. And it's, I definitely understand where a lot of that comes from, especially because a lot of people, just want to feel like they're living their lives. And for a lot of people, part of that is indoor dining. And for others, working in person is how they get their money. It's not, a negotiable part of life. But I mean, a couple of questions that I'm really coming back to is, what is this quote unquote normal that we say that we're returning to, and how that might be possible when there's still, this pandemic that can potentially disable people if they get infected?
Yeah, Janelle, you and I started around the same time at Cap Radio in 2021. And I totally agree with you. When we think about normal or say that word normal, I kind of always like hesitate because I'm like, what does that really mean? Because it's not like we just went back to like 2019. Kate, same to you. I mean, how has been navigating the pandemic, the lessons that you've learned, and your concerns moving forward, and just kind of your overall journey?
Definitely. So in March 2020, I was living in Berkeley with roommates, and we all had different perceptions, different priorities, and we had to have you know, what began a series of calibrating conversations about how we wanted to live, how we wanted to be experiencing our, you know, early 20s together while we were in this very, very serious, very unknown landscape that was extremely dangerous. So as a super extroverted person, it was really compromising to my social and emotional health to be so shut down. And I think that that was experienced by so many people. Just the mental health impact was really apparent for me. And, you know, in hearing your last segment with Dr. Dean Blumberg, just the way it evolved, right, when vaccines came out and there was more flexibility, I really had this moment where I was reevaluating where I was, where I wanted to be. And it felt like emerging from underwater, finding my new spot here at Cap Radio. But of course, as a healthcare reporter, too, there's a lot of balancing of, you know, how are people actually acting? How are people, you know, how can we be realistic about how people are acting and what makes sense to message to people, and also realistic about the, you know, potentially debilitating, disabling effects of this virus?
Yeah, I like that analogy, emerging from underwater, like a breath of fresh air. Okay, so let's get with the big picture. The both of you did tremendous work kind of walking people through what all of this means. What does it mean that the states of California's COVID emergency declaration is ending, Janelle?
Yeah, so I mean, for example, a lot of the way that things are changing is, you know, it's kind of mostly symbolic, this change, but it will, a lot of what is changing with the federal emergency when that ends in May, I think that will be a lot more impactful for most people. And I mean, even the California Department of Health says it's continuing to update, you know, its COVID-19 dashboard weekly. So I mean, that's one example of something that's not really changing. But Kate, do you want to talk a little bit more about what things look like?
Right. As Janelle says, it's symbolic mostly, right? There was flexibility enacted during the state of emergency of who could do what, when, where. Almost 550 of these proclamations have been sunsetted. There are just a couple left now. The state government says that they're hoping to preserve some privileges for healthcare workers that were enacted, like nurses being able to give Paxlovid, lab workers processing lab tests on their own. But for the most part, it's symbolic, and the federal emergency is what we're really you know, seeing actual changes with.
We were just talking about that before the show began. It was like, there's not like a lot of fanfare surrounding today, you know, because it is largely symbolic. But there is that big argument that there are people who believe that this declaration should have gone away a long time ago. However, others think it should still be in place. So walk us through these two very different views of how we should move forward as a state. Kate, I'll start with you.
Right. We asked a number of people in the public health space about this. Dr. Brad Pollack is a professor of epidemiology and a chairman of the Department of Public Health Sciences at UC Davis School of Medicine. And here's what he said about the change.
If it's a constant state of emergency, it's not an emergency any longer. So it actually detracts from the power of declaring an emergency. And we are way into this. We've never had anything of this duration before. So it makes sense to sort of be able to distinguish being an emergency situation from not.
And Dr. Pollack and the state and federal government all want to be clear that we're in a much better place to handle this with the vaccines, treatment, testing than we have over the course of the pandemic.
Yeah. And I mean, on the flip side of that, April Jean is the policy director of California COVID Justice. And that's a campaign with the nonprofit Public Health Advocates. And, you know, she has kind of a different point about the emergency ending.
We feel that that it's very premature. You know, we believe that, you know, in our word and with what we've seen occur as a result of the pandemic, that there's still a lot of groundwork that needs to be laid and investments that need to happen in order to ensure that communities who have been most impacted by the pandemic have an equitable shot at recovery.
Yeah, what we've learned over the last 3 years is the impact has been far from uniform. You know, Janelle, you mentioned this, that there is obviously a California state of emergency that is sunsetting, but there's also a federal state of emergency as well. When does that end, and what impact will that have?
Yeah, that ends May 11th, and it will kind of structure access to testing, vaccines, treatment based on insurance status. So, you know, obviously that's going to affect people who don't have insurance a lot harder than people who do. But in California, State Bill 1473 requires insurers to continue covering COVID treatment like Paxlovid and reimbursing people for 8 over-the-counter tests a month until November 11th. Then people will have to start to seek those services in-network if they're insured. But what happens after that and in general is kind of still up in the air, because the Biden administration has talked about making vaccines, treatment, and testing free or low cost for people who are uninsured or on Medi-Cal. But like I said, nothing's super firm yet.
All right, Kate. So as we mentioned, COVID is still here. People are going to continue to get sick. They're going to need testing. They're going to need care. And while most Californians have some sort of health insurance, that in-network piece, almost 3 million don't have insurance. So how will insurance or lack thereof factor into getting treated for COVID?
If you have insurance, things are essentially going to stay the same. If you don't have insurance, when things move over to the regular healthcare system, as Janelle is describing, it's confusing still. And people are worried that that confusion is actually going to stop a lot of people who are uninsured or underinsured from seeking treatment, even if they could find it through county health services. Amy Sisson is health officer for Yolo County and says the funding structure for keeping things low cost is still being figured out between the federal government, the state, and counties.
I think, you know, we're unfortunately returning to the hodgepodge that is America's healthcare system. It's a problem that we have with every other disease. And it's been wonderful that we've essentially had universal healthcare when it comes to COVID. And we've all enjoyed that.
And you can hear her dog joining us at the end there. As Janelle says, the federal government has said it wants things to remain low cost, but it's not clear how that will happen and how much will fall on the state and counties to fund.
So will vaccines still be free? And if so, for how long? And if you do have to pay out of pocket, any idea how much that could cost?
If you have insurance, yes, you will have to do in-network in the fall, but yes, vaccines will still be free. If you don't have insurance, as long as federal supplies last, they'll be free. When the vaccines are commercialized, they could cost up to $115 per dose if you're paying, you know, fully out of pocket. That's compared to $28 per dose for the flu vaccine. So when you pay fully out of pocket for the flu vaccine, you're paying much less. And those numbers are from the health policy analysis nonprofit, the Kaiser Family Foundation.
Yeah, that's almost a fourfold increase when compared to the vaccine for influenza. What about therapeutics like Paxlovid? How much could they cost?
Paxlovid currently costs the federal government $530 per series. It's expected to cost more when it transitions to the private market, although Pfizer, the company that makes it, has not disclosed the planned price. The federal government has said it will work to keep these medications relatively affordable. Again, if you have insurance, you're going to be able to access therapeutics relatively easily.
So things are obviously still in flux and being discussed. But right now, you can also still get free COVID tests. How and how long will that last?
So you can get 8 tests per month through your insurance through November. You'll still be able to get tests past that, just maybe a little bit more limited. I will probably be taking advantage of that. Probably will be stocking up a little bit. Most COVID tests have shelf lives of a year to 2 years. Uninsured people are likely going to keep paying full price for tests or can likely find them at county health clinics.
So, Janelle, we're talking about all of this because people are still going to get sick. They're still going to get COVID-19. That is a reality that we're living with. What have we learned about what to do when getting sick with COVID compared to 3 years ago, back in 2020?
So, like, you know, Dr. Pollack with UC Davis said earlier, you know, we're definitely in a different place now. We have vaccines, we have antiviral treatments that can help kind of reduce the initial impact of illness. And, you know, there are things like test-to-treat sites now in counties where you can get tested and prescribed Paxlovid on the spot, which is super important because you have to take the antiviral within, you know, 5 days of contracting COVID. And so, you know, with later variants of the virus, we've learned that, you know, the state now recommends testing within 3 to 5 days after exposure, since it is something that will start showing symptoms a little earlier than previous variants. And we've also learned that resting is just generally really important, especially to avoid prolonging COVID symptoms after the infection. We've also learned a lot about, you know, just isolating in general, how to create isolation zones if you live with other people, you know, opening windows or using air purifiers for ventilation, and then making sure everyone is wearing a common, you know, mask in common spaces if somebody is sick. And so if you are sick, you know, the CDC recommends isolating for 5 days, but often people test positive after that. So actually, when I got COVID last summer, I tested positive for 10 days. And, you know, a lot of people, CDC included, recommend that you use rapid tests, preferably a couple, to determine when you're negative.
Yeah, I know for me, Janelle, like my husband and I, we like stayed in different rooms when one of us got sick, and we just like avoided each other completely in a small space. So it definitely is possible. What are the rules in terms of like the workplace? What's changing with the measures that employers are taking?
Yeah, so because COVID-19 supplemental sick leave ended in California at the end of last year, you know, that's an example of one of the proclamations sunsetting a little bit earlier. If you test positive, you'll have to use regular sick days unless your workplace still provides specific COVID leave. So it's always a good idea to check in, you know, on your workplace if it has specific COVID-19 policies. And like Kate said, it's probably a good idea to stock up on rapid tests now, since you actually can still get some free via the government. And, you know, you can also qualify for family or medical leave or short-term disability leave and benefits, depending on the extent or severity of your illness if you get COVID. And that family or medical leave might also be available if you're helping take care of, you know, a sick family member.
We have learned some really hard learning lessons about equity. You know, like I mentioned, oh, my husband and I could avoid each other in our home. But that's not the case if you live in multi-generational households. And we know that the state also tried hard to prioritize getting the first vaccines out to people from underserved communities, and it just didn't go as well as it should have. What are we learning about how accessible vaccines, treatment, and testing are, Kate?
We've learned from the CDC's analysis that people living in counties that are both high poverty areas and majority Black, Hispanic, or American Indian or Alaska Native are less likely to have access to COVID-19 treatment facilities and are also less likely to be treated with antivirals. So trusted messengers like people in community-based organizations are so, so necessary to get the word out about these things, about vaccines, about antivirals, about testing, about resources that people can access, and to connect people to preventative care and responsive care. As funding decreases for these community-based organizations, it's going to be really hard to improve accessibility, to make sure that you know, that people who are in the most hard hit areas are getting the resources that they need. And as the federal funding runs out for things like vaccines, it's going to be harder and more confusing to navigate. So these are definitely conversations that we're actively having and that public health officials are very, very concerned about people falling through the cracks regarding.
In the last minute or two that we have, I want to get to a point. A big evolution is how we actually test and how our metrics have changed as a state to determine whether to potentially declare a new state of emergency. Kate, how do we test for COVID differently? Wastewater has become a key player in this, right?
Right. Wastewater is a hugely important tracker for how much community transmission there is. If wastewater data shows a high concentration, it's one of the leading pieces of data people are looking at. Here's what Dr. Brad Pollack said about what might cause another emergency declaration.
I think that the preponderance of evidence for having very high infection rates, maybe seeing hospitalizations spike up very, very rapidly, these would, from COVID, those would be the kinds of signals that would cause us to reconsider, you know, declaring the emergency again.
So Dr. Pollack says it's possible we'd declare another state of emergency. It's not probable, but these things like wastewater are what we're tracking.
Yeah, and Janelle, we have, you know, about 45 seconds left, but I do want to end with a soundbite that you had from public health advocates. If we can take a quick listen and then have you close out our show.
Perfect. There's a vast difference between the accessibility of being able to go to a familiar community-based organization that I trust, I know, there are people that look like me, there are people who speak my language, there are people who understand my cultural needs. So when I walk in there and I ask a specific question about vaccinations or even historical consequences that racism has propagated, right? So when you have that sort of safety net and now it's gone, what does that mean for the exacerbation potentially of COVID rates?
Yeah. And Janelle, what they're really hitting on is ongoing recovery and the gaps that still remain, right, Janelle?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the pandemic after these states of emergency end is just going to become one that's easier for rich people with access to insurance, masks, tests, and steady medical care to survive.
So. And that is Kate Wolf and Janelle Salonga with CAP Radio. And that is it for Insight today. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.